Let's continue. We're talking about the job photographing takeoffs, and we're at the point where we're discussing a plane, the second or third plane that you were photographing, that whose engine quit just as you just as it launched.
Well, we had a policy. I said they had a policy. On the ship, it was always accompanied by destroyers. We had usually three, sometimes four destroyers. And when a pilot went over like that, the destroyer picked him up. Well, the destroyer would bring him back alongside. And there would be a big hoopla about that, you know. And it was customary for the destroyer to be awarded by enough gee dunk for the entire crew. Now that was ice cream.
Gee dunk?
Gee dunk. The ship had the ability to make ice cream. I mean, big as it was, and over 3,000 people on it sometimes, you know, it made ice cream. And it would exchange ice cream for the rescue pilot. That was a sort of customary thing. But getting back to it, they had painted the ship black, and it was supposedly a mite type carrier. And we were dispatched to Ulithi. And there were some other ships along, I think. If I'm not mistaken, North Carolina may have been in the group that went along, but there were other ships, and we got to Ulithi, and we anchored, and as far as we could see, there were ships. It was a real assembly, and we had a few days there, and I don't think any of us went ashore from there. Then they sent a group of carriers down to the raid on Tokyo, and I was in the group, and I assumed the other ships that were there went to Iwo Jima. So we went to Tokyo, and the job of our ship was to fly night protection. The other carriers were pulling in close in the daytime and raid Japan, and they would pull out, and we would pull in close to protect the other ships. And we went from a hot climate to a cold climate, and I had a problem with a nosebleed. So the whole time the other carriers were bombing Tokyo, I was in the sick bay with a nosebleed. But at any rate, we got detached from that and sent to Iwo Jima, my nosebleed to clear up. And just as we were coming into the Iwo Jima situation, we were attacked by kamikazes and bombs and all that sort of stuff. Well, two or more waves coming in, and we were badly.
This would have been February or March of 45?
February 22, I think. Mm-hmm. February 22. And we took, I think, about 13 different hits. And all those six or seven were kamikazes. The ship listed a little bit. The bow was torn up pretty badly. A lot of things were knocked out of use. But and they were able to get the boilers running correctly, the power went. And we straightened up, and we dispatched ourselves, shall we say, away from the danger zone. We headed back. In the process of the attack, we all had been assigned battle stations. My battle station was a flag bridge. The ship was rigged for an admiral, if we had one, and this was his operations center, the flag bridge. It was not occupied, and so that was my battle station. I had taken my camera, my Mitchell, up to the battle station and had secured it and placed a tarpaulin over it. I guess I was about 4 or 5 flights and steps to get to it. So when General Porter sounded off Iwo Jima, General Porter sounded, we all made for our station. And I went to my battle station. And then more bombs were just going off all around every which way.
Were you able to take pictures of the attacks?
I was not able to take pictures of the attack. Time I got to my battle station and took the tarpaulin off and got it secured and blind and ready to run, the attack was over. That was just a few minutes. I was able to make some photographs of the damage later on, but the actual attack itself, I did not get. And that's when the tarpaulin I had used to protect the camera caught on fire, and it was about dusk dark, and I couldn't put the fire out. The photo officer came up and was checking on what I was doing, and saw that I had a blaze going on and it was getting dark. He saw that I was stomping the flames and they were flaring up due to the wind. He started stomping. We both were stomping. And I suggested a way to put out the fire, which he said, do it. And I did, and I put out the fire. And so far as I knew, that was the last flame on deck, because fires form light and are very easily seen at night on the ocean. So, we secured our material as best we could, and we started cleaning up. We were all issued wartime rations, or combat rations, whatever you want to call it. The galley was closed, and we didn't have any fresh food or that sort of thing. And it was a matter of cleaning up and getting the dead ready for burial.
Were there any casualties among the photographers?
No casualties among the photographers. We had total casualties, I think of cold deaths rather, were about 120. And after we got things lined up, got out of the range of the enemy attack and that sort of thing, we had buried. We buried, I think, 90 on the first day. We had the usual burial ceremony. We had three sites. The bodies were placed on the underneath the flag. The burial device was lifted, the body slid off into the ocean. And that was the usual ceremony went with that. We had a chaplain on board, and I think his name was Flowers, I'm not sure. It was a Protestant chaplain, and I think he may have been from South Carolina, I don't know that. But we buried the crew. And then we had some two kamikazes of this guy were gone, whose bodies we had to bury. So he buried those plants. And I remember not the prayer for the crew, because that was too long, but I remember the prayer he said for the kamikazes. And I think it went like this. Dear God, give us courage to live for our country, and these men had courage to die for theirs. Amen. Hold the side with them. Once we got to some degree of cleanliness, shall we say, on the ship, and the galley was working, we had a meal. And the first meal we had that I remember after the attack was steak. Of course, it was usually country-style steak in the Navy. You didn't get real steak. It was all country-style steak. And seemed like we had pie island burgers for dessert. But it was a big deal. Mm-hmm. Anyway.
So how long was that? From the 22nd, when the attack occurred, to when you got steak and pie out of the mud?
I think that was maybe two or three days after. They had to get the stuff lined up. The first stop that we made, as I recall, we put in the Eniwetok. And I assumed to get some fuel or whatever, and we got and get further orders and that sort of stuff. And usually, when we pulled into a port, we frequently were buzzed by other planes. And this was the first time that we saw this twin-engine Lockheed plane come over and fly straight up. It was some sight to see. But at any rate, our instructions were to go from Eniwetok to Honolulu, and we didn't know what was going to happen. On the way to Honolulu, we received word that the Army had lost the plane with a high officer, I think it was a general aboard, and it was suggested that we do what we could to see if it could be located. So, believe it or not, they got an airplane ready, and they backed the ship down to get enough into the wind, shall we say, so we could fly off. And we launched it off the stern, and it flew around, and it never found any evidence of it until the night. And we went on in, and we tied up at the dock there. Whenever the ship came in, usually, I was to say, when the ship came in, it was met by a band. That was sort of a customary thing for a capital ship. And we pulled into this dock, and the band was playing. And there was an exchange of people coming and going and coming and going. And we stayed there. I don't remember what we did. We didn't leave the ship. We stayed on the ship. And after they got all the exchange going, they took the ramps down, and then the band started playing California, Here We Come. And the ship went wild. But we didn't go to California. We went to Bremerton, Washington, where we pulled in. Pulled in up Puget Sound, up by Seattle. And tied up the shipyard. Before we even got to the shipyard, there were workers from the shore that came aboard, and they cut a hole in the side of the ship big enough to drive the ship through, I mean, of the truck, through to the hangar deck. And they were getting it ready to be repaired. And we pulled into the dry dock at Bremerton. And those sailors who could get leave and get off the ship and go ashore to Bremerton or to Seattle or wherever it was, as many left as could. And they filled up the restaurants and the bars. And it just so happened that that was on St. Patrick's Day. And there was a lot of celebrating, but it ain't Patrick's Day. And I asked people, do you know what your favorite drink was? And of course, nobody would guess what their favorite drink was. It was milk. You go into a bar and you drink milk. We'd had enough of this dry milk nobody wanted, you know, it was just terrible. But at any rate, we tied up there in Bremerton, and the ship's crew was divided up, I think, into three groups and given leave while the ship was being repaired. I got word that my brother, who was in the Coast Guard, was home. I was not in the first group to leave. So I went down to the chaplain. You know about going to the chaplain. I went down to the chaplain and got a TS slip. I won't get into you what that was. At any rate, I got permission to leave early, right then. So I left, I flew home, and my brother and I shared a visit together.
Mm-hmm.
That was the, I flew back. But while I was home, my mother got some extra ration tickets for her to buy meats and that sort of stuff. And I brought some of those back with me. And back to the ship. And while they were mending the ship, we stayed in the lab. Because that was our place. There was a member of the crew of the lab that was married from New York. And his wife came out. And they rented a motel room. A room of a sort. And she invited the crew over for supper. So we all went out to her house for supper. But before then, I gave her my ration tickets. And she goes off to use my ration tickets to buy steak for the lab crew. And the grocer said, this is not your name on here. This is Milton Fields' name on here. She says, I'm his wife. So she used my tickets, posing as my wife, to buy steaks for the lab crew. At any rate, I tell you that because it came back years and years later. This fellow and his wife came from Connecticut going to Florida and stopped in to see me. And they came to the house. I was not there. And his wife introduced herself to my wife as the first Miss Field. Of course, that took some explaining. At any rate, they patched us up at Bremerton, and we went on a little check-down cruise. I had the Puget Sound, had a little trouble, one of the guns didn't work right, and we went on down, headed out, but we stopped off at San Francisco. And while we were there at San Francisco for a few days to get supplies or whatever it was that we were doing, my brother, who was stationed by at the Coast Guard, Port Richmond, came aboard. And he took me out to lunch. He took me out to a steakhouse where I had my first grilled steak. I never had one before.
Mm-hmm.
And he ordered us some wine to go with the meat. And I had never had any wine with a meal before.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a real good visit. And I took him down to one of our rooms that we used with the lab, made a series of photographs of him in the uniform and a reproduction of any rate, we stayed there for a while, and then we went to Pearl Harbor when I was there. And we were training from Pearl Harbor some more ships about like we had been doing. And then we got word that the atomic bomb hadn't been dropped. And that was difficult for me to understand. And they dropped another one. And then there was peace. And it was a great relief. There are those who question the use of the atomic bomb. It was probably should have been done. It saved a lot of lives.
Mm-hmm.
So we pulled back into Pearl Harbor, and as quickly as they could, they converted it into a troop ship. We had bunks and toilets and sleeping places everywhere, places to eat. The galley ran full time, and we loaded up as the first troop ship bringing back veterans. They called it the magic carpet. You may have heard of the term. And we loaded up there at Pearl Harbor, and we had a big send-off. And we pulled into San Francisco under the Golden Gate Bridge. Cars were on the bridge blowing the horns. And docking the ship was out to sea as it was a sailboat. Boats were around blowing the horns. Fireboats were shooting off. And we tied in, the bands were playing, the new people there. It's one of the biggest events I've ever seen, ever. It was a great, great day. We didn't stay there long before they sent us back to make the trip again. When we got back to Pearl, they sent me, I was discharged from the ship, and went over to John Rogers Field, in which I was over there with the Naval Hydrographic Office. I was assigned to that because of my knowledge of lithography, map making, and that sort of stuff. And when I got there, they were in the process of closing the office. The people who were in the office had been out there too long,
mm-hmm.
and they were from the Washington area, and they had been assigned planes, but they were to be flown back to Washington, D.C. Well, since I had more points than they did, I was going to fly back to Washington, D.C. But since they knew more folks than I did, they flew back, and I was given the job of closing up the lab. So I closed up the lab, got the equipment stored, and went on a one-man draft back to Washington,
mm-hmm.
D.C. Suit was Maryland, that's where it looked at.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so when were you, when did you leave the Navy?
I left the Navy in April. Another little incident that may be amusing.
Mm-hmm.
We received a Christmas gift while we were out at sea. Now, the photo lab did not have toilet facilities or any of that sort of stuff. So we had to go down to a shower in the toilet about 2 decks below.
Mm-hmm.
To get there, we had to pass through a batch of bunks that were usually occupied by other sailors and all that sort of stuff. So one, and that Christmas I got a batch of scented soap. I took my scented soap down and took me a shower. And I was smelling good. And when I came back up through those dormitories or whatever you want to call it, spaces, there's all sort of heads popping out of the beds, whistles, yelling, things saying, when I got back up to the lab, I threw that soap out and went. I didn't use that scented soap anymore. I was stationed there at Suitland, Maryland for a while. A little side issue on that. When I came in to the railroad station by Washington,
mm-hmm.
from the West Coast, I met a man that was leaving, going overseas, that had gone through boot camp with me. He had served the entire war season at Bainbridge in the band. But since he didn't have any points, they had sent him out. And I met him at the train station. He was going out and I was coming in. But I stayed on at Suitland, Maryland until April when I was discharged. And I think I was discharged over at Bainbridge.
Mm-hmm.
I made negatives for maps, big maps. They had Suitland.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a young man in there, a little older than I was, doing the same thing. He liked to ice skate. So he taught me how to ice skate. I had a little social life there. Not a great deal.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But I was discharged in April.
So you left the Navy in April of 46. And then, well, you must, I understand you went to East Carolina College
yeah.
at that point. Did what decided you to go to college at that?
Well, I don't know. I had decided to go to law school, become a lawyer, but I had debated a long time about whether I should go to take journalism. And I was considering going to the University of Missouri because of the rating
mm-hmm.
in journalism. But comments that I had heard caused me to want to go to law school. So when I got out, my daddy found me a job. I was a carpenter's help. When I got a chance, I went up to Carolina. About enrolling by Carolina in the summer of 46, and it was crowded. It was crowded. But I heard that East Carolina had a pretty long program. 2 years I could go to the pretty long program at East Carolina for 2 years, then transfer to Carolina and go 3 years. After 2 years in Carolina, I get a B.S. another year, get a law degree. So I'd save a little time. So I decided to go to East Carolina.
Mm-hmm.
And back then, everybody, I won't say everybody, but a lot of people would pitch up, hitchhikers. And so I hitchhiked my way down to East Carolina.
Mm-hmm.
And checked it out and enrolled and started in the summer of 46. There were several other boys who did the same, who were enrolled at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
That got me into ECTC, as it was known at that time.
Mm-hmm. Did you end up going to Carolina for grad school, or law school?
No, no. I stayed on at East Carolina, ACDC. And we had a professor, whose name I can't remember, but he's very well liked, and he had finished at Emory. And he said it would be a good idea.
In what department was this professor?
He was teaching history, the best I can recall. Okay. A nice guy, liked him a lot. At any rate, there were three of us at that time that I ever know who we were considering almost. Well, actually, there was four. I had a friend who went to the University of Richmond, but at any rate, this professor persuaded these two, and persuaded three of us to go to Emory. And I was going to Emory after my 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
But at any rate, I had done some photography around school here and there. And I got a chance to edit the annual.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought being editor of the annual would look better on the resume, maybe, than some other things. So I changed and become an English major, and became an English major, and stayed on and edited the annual. When I finished in 49,
mm-hmm.
I went to Emory.
Mm-hmm.
One of the students who was in the pre-law with me here, a good friend of mine, I wound up marrying his sister. So, I guess it was the right place to be at the right time.
Mm-hmm. I'm afraid we're going to have to stop there. We're about to run out of tape.